Good morning, YouTube. Professor Jiang here with another video update on the situation in the Middle East. I wanted to originally do this talk next week because I wanted to get a haircut this weekend and surprise everyone. But on Twitter, many of you have been clamoring for the next edition in this series, so here we are. In my last video, I discussed how Isaac Newton built the intellectual foundations for Christian Zionism, which is driving American Middle East policy today. And today, I want to explain to you why Christian Zionism is such a powerful force in the world. As you know, Netanyahu is visiting Washington this week, meeting with senior lawmakers, including with President Donald Trump in the White House. And this most definitely signals that Israel and the United States will resume airstrikes against Iran, and we will see an increase in the escalation ladder in this war in the Middle East. So why is this happening? And it's happening because there are four major factions in this anti-Iran coalition that's driving this war. The first faction in this coalition, of course, are the Christian Zionists, who are trying to achieve biblical prophecy. Then you have the Zionists, who want to achieve the Greater Israel Project, which they believe is a promised land that Yahweh gave to the Israelite people as part of the covenant together. And this is made explicit in the Bible. The third faction is the global financial elite, Wall Street, City of London. Because for them, if they're able to control Iran, the Strait of Hormuz, they're able to control not only the vast oil reserves of Iran, but also global trade. Thus, negating the BRICS project, thus negating China's Silk and Road project. Then you have the American empire, the military-industrial complex, the deep state, whatever you want to call these people. But they are first and foremost interested in maintaining American hegemony. And if they're able to control the entire Middle East, then they will be able to maintain this unipolar world. Now, when I say that these four factions are working together, you may think that they are in a dark, smoke-filled room in an underground bunker in Washington, D.C. somewhere. And that is not what's happening. In fact, it's entirely possible they don't even talk to each other. So let me give you a metaphor to explain to you how these four groups are working together. Let's just say that there's a mountain somewhere. And on this mountain, people believe that God lives on this mountain. Now, the Christian Zionists want to build a road to this mountaintop in order to be with God. Unfortunately, there are people who live on this mountain. They need to be exterminated. A war has to be fought. But it's all for the greater good because they will be able to be with God. The Zionists are involved because God and the Zionists know each other from history. And so the Christian Zionists need the Zionists involved in this project. They really see the Zionists as a ritual sacrifice in order to win favor with God. And the Christian Zionists are involved with building this world because they see the Christian Zionists as a useful tool in order to be with their true God. And so when they reach the mountaintop, then their real God will recognize their faith and kill the Christian Zionists. So it's a cynical partnership between the Christian Zionists and the Zionists. And they both need each other for now until they reach the mountaintop. Then you have the global financial elite. And these people are opportunists, they're speculators. They are first and foremost interested in generating more wealth for themselves and their clients. They themselves have no ideas. They themselves have no real vision for the world. They just want to make more money. And in the energy and the commitment and the faith of the Christian Zionists and the Zionists, they see an opportunity to monetize this faith. If the Christian Zionists and the Zionists are working hard to build this road to the mountaintop, then they can provide financing for this road. Also, when this road is built, they can start to collect toll booths, right? So that's why they're involved, because they see this as a money-making opportunity for them. They're only interested in making money. These people, Wall Street, City of London, they're so wealthy because all they care about is money. In fact, for the right price, they'd be perfectly willing to sell their own children. Okay, that's who these people are. Then you have the American Empire. And the American Empire, it's important to understand that these are first and foremost bureaucrats. They have really cushy jobs, sitting in an office somewhere, pretending to work. And they need to justify their existence. They need to explain why they have trillions of dollars in their budget. And so this Christian Zionist project to reach the mountaintop provides the justification. They can say, okay, well, you know what? If these Christian Zionists, these Zionists, if they're the ones who are going to go and lobby the politicians and bribe the politicians and pressure the politicians to build this road, then we'll say that we'll provide military protection in order to justify our existence. Okay, so they're trying to do as little work as possible in order to maintain their very cushy jobs, sitting somewhere in an air-conditioned office. And that's it. Now, that's the structure of their relationship with each other. They're all interested in reaching that mountaintop for different reasons. But once they reach that mountaintop, then they'll have their disagreements. And how to reach that mountaintop, they won't be aligned with. So the example here is that the Christian Zionists and the Zionists are very much interested in using ground troops to force regime change in Iran. The financiers and the empire, they're risk averse. So they really don't want to use ground troops. They want to achieve regime change slowly, steadily, in a way that contains risk. And so there's going to be that disagreement about whether or not to use ground troops. In the end, I think the Christian Zionists and the Zionists will win out. So let me explain to you why, using game theory, why the Christian Zionists are the dominant power in this relationship, even though the financials control the money, and even though the American Empire controls the armaments. So here, let me introduce to you the universal law of game theory. Once you master this formula, once you truly understand the ramifications, the nuances, the subtleties of this law, then you will have a much more clear and deeper understanding of how the world works. Okay, and this formula, it's very simple. It goes like this. If you look at game theories, all games, the people who always win the game, they win because of this formula, which is mass times energy times coordination. All right, so mass is just the number of people times energy, which is the level of motivation of these people, times coordination, which is the ability of these people to work together to achieve their end. Some things to keep in mind about this formula. First of all, the different factors are not weighted equally. So coordination is the most important factor, and it's weighted at least three times as much as mass. Then you have energy. And energy is what's second most important, and it's weighted twice as much as mass. And depending on the game, the weightings can be different. But please keep this in mind. Coordination is what really matters, followed by energy, followed ultimately by mass. So if I explain that, let me explain to you what each term means and how we can measure each factor to get a more mathematical understanding of this formula. Mass is just the number of people involved, but what's important to measure is their cohesion, how much they like each other, how much they're willing to work together. So, for example, you look at Japan and China. Japan is a much more cohesive society than China. So in terms of mass, Japan is actually stronger than China, even though China has 10 times or 5 times as many people as Japan. Then you look at energy. Energy is the level of motivation. And usually when we think of energy, we think of physical energy. But actually, in this formula, it's mental energy that really matters. Because if you think about it, it's mental energy that is the most expensive. And so you need the most amount of motivation in order to achieve mental energy. So let me give you an example of this. Let's just say there are two people. The first person, he's digging a hole in the ground for 12 hours a day for a whole year. Then you have another person who every day is seeking to improve himself. So he's constantly in the process of self-reflection, writing down the ways that he can improve, and creating a strategy, a formula for how he can improve himself. Well, according to this formula, the second person is expending much more energy than the first person, even though if we just look at it, it seems like it's the first person that's doing all the work, the second person just sitting around all day, just thinking. And the reason why is, in the world, the three hardest words to say for a human being is, I am wrong. To say I'm wrong is to negate yourself, to negate your ego, to admit that you have failings. To say you are wrong is also to commit to a policy of self-improvement, self-change. It's also a tremendous loss of face to say I'm wrong before your peers. You lower your status. You lose face. And that's why people who are more energetic, who are more motivated, they are much more open to change. They're much more willing to accept their limitations. They're much more willing to commit to self-improvement. So energy is a measure of motivation, and we can measure motivation by a group's openness to accepting its limitations, its failings. Okay, so that's the idea of energy. Then the third aspect of this formula is the idea of coordination. And coordination can be divided into two different types. The first type is conscious coordination. Second type is subconscious coordination. Conscious coordination is when you're led by someone. It could be a leader, it could be a bureaucracy, it could be a patriarch. Subconscious coordination is when there's no clear leader or clear direction, people just subconsciously work together. It's almost like a dance. And of the two, subconscious coordination is the more powerful. When people get together and they sort of conspire together, that leads to all sorts of problems. You don't want conspiracy. You don't want open conspiracies. So let me explain to you why open conspiracies or secret conspiracies are bad policy. Okay. The first reason is it's really hard to maintain the secrecy of a conspiracy. Eventually, word's going to leak out that these people are conspiring together. And if word leaks out that these people are conspiring together, that forces other people to conspire together in this game. So, if you are conspiring together, you have to keep it secret in order to maintain your advantage. It's very, very hard to keep it secret. In fact, you probably waste more time and energy keeping it secret than you do in actually trying to implement your conspiracy. Okay, so that's the first reason why conspiracies are not a good idea. Second reason is, in most games, conspiracies are illegal. It's considered cheating. So you lose plausible deniability when you are conspiring together and when you're keeping notes and when you're meeting in a room together and plotting together. The third reason is the most important. Okay, the third reason why you don't want to conspire together is everyone has an ego. Everyone is trying to maximize his or her self-interest in a conspiracy. And that immediately leads to friction, conflict, debate. So this creates friction in the relationship. So subconscious coordination is much more powerful than conscious coordination. It allows for frictionless cooperation and allows for plausible deniability and allows for secrecy. So examples of subconscious coordination are families, ethnicities, religions. Okay. So having said that, okay, having presented this formula, mass times energy times coordination, I want to now give you some examples to understand why this formula works. Okay, so let's just say we're playing individual games. Well, if we're playing an individual game, one versus one, then the formula is like this. Mass becomes one, coordination becomes one, so we're only left with energy. So what this formula is telling us that in an individual player game, the person who is most motivated, the person who is most willing to commit to self-improvement will win this game. And the idea of constant self-improvement confirms the research of K. Anders Ericsson. He coined the phrase deliberate practice, and he argues that those who are most proficient in individual activities, whether it's music, sports, are those who are most committed to a policy of self-reflection and self-improvement, because that is the hardest thing to do. Now let's look at team sports. In team sports, the mass is constant, so we can actually take out mass. And what we're left with is the idea of energy times coordination. So in a team sport, the team that is most likely to win are the teams that are most willing to coordinate together subconsciously and most willing to commit to constant self-reflection and self-improvement. And now let's look at the third example, which is, what is an example of the most powerful grouping in human history? And that, of course, is the nation state. Okay, the nation state is the most powerful form of human organization in the world. And if we just use this formula and analyze all nation states around the world, what we will discover is that there are four nation states that are dominant in each region. So in the Western Hemisphere, it's obviously the United States. In Europe, it's going to be Germany. Okay, in Europe, Germany is the most dominant nation state according to this formula. In Southeast Asia, it's Japan, and in the Middle East, it is Israel. So over time, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we can expect these four nation states to dominate each region as the world loses unipolarity and moves towards multipolarity. Okay, so now I want to discuss how to maximize this formula. Remember, the trick is, how do you create subconscious coordination in your team? And believe it or not, the answer is to have a really powerful story. A powerful story, it's a way to frame your understanding of the world, and it's also a script. It allows you to understand how to behave in a certain context. All right, so let me explain to you the power of a story. All right, let's do a thought experiment first. Let's imagine that we have the power to present every single story in human history, to every single person who's ever lived and who's still alive today. And the stories we present include Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Disney movies, Homer, the Iliad, the Bible. Every single story that humans have ever produced is presented to every single person. And then 10 years from now, we talk to every single person again and figure out what story that person most remembered and tabulate the results. When we do so, then what we will discover is that most people will have remembered three stories. Okay? The first story is Plato's allegory of the cave. The second story is the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus. The third story is the second coming of Jesus. Okay? So let me explain all three stories. Okay, so Plato's allegory of the cave, it's interesting because it's really Plato's reimagining of the trial of Socrates. For him, his mentor Socrates, who was forced to drink hemlock by Athenians for the crime of corrupting the youth of Athens, for Plato, Socrates was this truth teller who discovered the truth of the world through philosophy. And he committed himself to revealing this truth to the Athenian people. And in response, the Athenian people condemned him to death because, as I mentioned previously, no one likes to say, I'm wrong. And no one likes to be told they're wrong. The second story, the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus, it's interesting because it is actually a reimagining of Plato's allegory of the cave, because Jesus was this truth teller sent by God to earth to reveal the truth of the universe to people. In response, we killed Jesus. Okay, so the allegory of the cave and the crucifixion of Jesus, it's really just one story. Second coming of Jesus is really compelling because it's marking the end of history. It's telling us when everything will come to an end and when we will have achieved paradise and reconciliation with God. So these three stories that are most memorable, it's really just one story. And it's appealing to us because as humans, we're born with three questions embedded in our hearts, in our soul. The first question is, where did we come from? Second question is, why are we here? Third question is, where are we going? And the power of these three stories, Plato's allegory of the cave, the crucifixion of Jesus, the second coming of Jesus, it's really helping us answer all three questions in a compelling and convincing manner. And that's why Christian Zionism is so powerful, because it's the most powerful story out there. That's why there's so many Christians. That's why Christian Zionists are the most energetic, the most motivated, the most committed people that you can ever meet. And again, the story, it is really a script. As a Christian Zionist, you want to achieve the story. It is so compelling, so powerful to you as a person. In fact, you're willing to sacrifice your own life in order to achieve this story. That's how beautiful it is. And that explains to us, that helps us understand why Christian Zionism is the most powerful force in the world today. Because for the people who believe in Christian Zionism, they feel as though they discovered the secret of the universe and they must bring this story into fruition, into reality. Now, next thing I want to talk about is, if it is true that this story, the crucifixion of Jesus and the second coming, is such a powerful story, then in theory, we should have seen the story. We should have seen people try to achieve the story before, and also it's telling us that the story, Christian Zionism, will never ever go away. It will continue until the end of human history. So what I will do now is tell you that actually 1,500 years ago, they also tried to achieve the completion of this story. So, 1,500 years ago, about 600 Common Era, there was this massive war going on between the two major powers of that age. The Byzantine Empire, based in Constantinople, and then you have the Sassanian Persian Empire. And this war just devastated the entire world. People were dying, people were starving, people were in debt, people were in slavery, there was religious persecution. It really felt like the end times, the end of days. Also at this time, the Jews were banned from Jerusalem, which is their holy city. It's the city of their God, Yahweh. And so the Jews in the diaspora were plotting throughout all this time how to return to Jerusalem. They were kicked out of Jerusalem because many centuries before, they had fought three major rebellions against the Roman Empire. And in each time, the Jews lost because they were fighting the Roman Empire. And each time, the Jews went to the desert of Arabia. Why did these armies, defeated armies, go into the desert of Arabia? Because the Romans really hated sand. They could only be safe in the desert of Arabia. And when they went to the desert of Arabia, they went there with commitment to eventually reclaim Jerusalem. To wait for the arrival of the Messiah to lead them to final victory against the Romans. And while they were in the desert of Arabia, they were interacting with the local Arab pagans. And in this interaction, there's a process of syncretization where Jewish belief was being meshed into Arab pagan belief. But as I told you, the most compelling story always wins out. So eventually, the Jewish belief that the Messiah would eventually come to create the Messianic age of truth, justice, eventually it won over the Arab people. And this would become the foundation for the modern belief of Islam. And so during this time, there's a widespread belief in the Arabian desert that a Messiah will eventually come to unite the Jewish people and lead them into final victory against the Roman Empire, which at this time had not become the Byzantine Empire. Back in the Jewish diaspora, they were trying to figure out how to return to Jerusalem. One group in this Jewish diaspora allied themselves to the Persians, who promised them that they would, like Cyrus the Great, take them back to Jerusalem and build the third temple for them. And at first they succeeded. The Persians were able to conquer Jerusalem, and the Jews were able to reclaim the city for themselves. And they were now in the process of building the third temple. The problem, though, is that at this time in history, the majority of the population were actually Christian. So the Christians rebelled against the Jews, and then the Christians call for help to the Byzantine Empire. At this time, a new general, Heraclius, had emerged, and he had usurped the throne from the emperor. And so now the new emperor, Heraclius, he has a legitimacy problem. And so he decided, like, the best way to prove that he, in fact, has the mandate of heaven, that he has the will of God supporting him, he decides that he has to reclaim Jerusalem and basically massacre all the Jews. So at this time in history, it seemed all hope was lost. Jews were being massacred. It seemed as though the Antichrist, Heraclius, has emerged to destroy the Jewish nation. Now, the funny thing about Jewish eschatology is that when all hope seems lost, when the Antichrist has emerged, when the Jewish nation is about to be completely destroyed, that's when Jewish people are most convinced the Jewish Messiah will emerge to lead them into war and into the final victory against the Antichrist and usher in the Messianic Age, where they will reconstitute the nation of Israel, bring everyone home from the Jewish diaspora, build a third temple, and create a millennium of peace, truth, and justice. So, the Jews go into the Arabian desert, and now they're looking for their Messiah, the promised Messiah. And there are different candidates, but ultimately, they settle on one charismatic man who is absolutely convinced that he is, in fact, the Jewish Messiah. We don't know his name, okay? A lot of his biography has been lost to us over the course of history. But today we refer to him as Muhammad, okay? Muhammad was the Jewish Messiah. And the Jews were looking to him to lead them into final victory against the Byzantines and the Antichrist, Heraclius. And he took up the call. And according to game theory, all he had to do was say three things, and he would unite the entire world behind him. And once he did so, he would become a tidal wave to wash over the old order and build the Messianic Age. All he had to do was say three things, okay? The first thing he had to say was, I am the Jewish Messiah. I am the fulfillment of the prophecy. I am the promised one. I am the anointed one. Okay, that's the first thing. Second thing he needed to say is that we are all the children of Abraham. Jews, Christians, Muslims, we are all descended from Abraham. And as such, we are all the children of God. And as such, this land was promised to us by God, and therefore, debt, slavery, landlessness, it's all evil in the eyes of God. And therefore, we must create a revolution to ensure that everyone has land, that debt is canceled, that slavery is eliminated from this world. So that's why I'm here. I'm the Messiah to lead us to final victory in the pursuit of the Messianic Age. And the third thing that Muhammad had to say in order to unite the world is, all these religious differences are idiotic. Zoroastrianism, Catholic Christianity, Nestorian Christianity, Orthodox Christianity, Judaism. It does not, these factions are against the will of God. We are all the children of God, and therefore we can all celebrate God in our own way. These factions, these divisions only exist for the priest class to exploit us, for the emperor, for the political class to unite, divide and conquer us. Okay, so you are free to separate your religion. You're free to celebrate God, your faith, in any way you seem fit. Okay, and this is what eventually led to something called the Concordia of Medina, where one of the founding ideologies of Islam is religious tolerance. You are free to practice your faith in any way. You're free to love God in any way. And because he said these three things, Muhammad would lead the world's first global revolution against the established order, and thus creating the basic structure of Islam. Unfortunately, Muhammad died before he could complete his mission, but that didn't stop many Jews from believing that he was in fact the Jewish Messiah, because in their eyes, the prophecy has been fulfilled. First of all, the Arabs were able to reconquer Jerusalem and return the Jews to Jerusalem, thus reconstituting the nation of Israel. Second of all, they built the third temple. Today we call it the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's still there in Jerusalem, you can still visit it. But back then they thought it was a third temple. And the third thing is, they did usher in a millennium of peace, prosperity, truth, justice. Today we call it the Islamic Golden Age. Okay, so for many Jews, the prophecy had been fulfilled, and that's why many Jews converted to Islam during this process. And many Jews would emerge as the top administrators, the top officials of the Islamic Golden Age, making tremendous contributions to world civilization in the process. Unfortunately, what we also know about this period is that the early followers of Muhammad, called the Companions, they were all basically eliminated in the power struggle that emerged after the death of Muhammad. Okay, so I know that for many of you, this is extremely controversial history, and I don't have enough time to go into the specific details. So what I will do is, in the description below, I'm going to link a really awesome paper written by two Jewish religious historians about this time, so you can have a better understanding of how Muhammad really is the Jewish Messiah. I'm also going to link to have a lot of like wiki links, so you can do some more background research into this period. It's really fascinating, and I apologize, I don't have enough time to go into more details about this period. Okay, so to summarize, according to game theory, the universal law of game theory, Christian Zionists will emerge as dominant power in the Middle East. They're the ones driving U.S. policy right now. They will eventually overwhelm both the American empire and the global financial elite. They will force the United States to send in ground troops and invade Iran in order to implement regime change. And they will basically get whatever they want. So it seems as though we figured out history. It seems we're able to predict the future by using game theory properly and systematically. And honestly, we're able to have a very clear insight into the trajectory of history. The problem, though, is game theory is not that easy. Okay? Why? Because according to game theory, when it seems like they structure the game, when there seems to be a trajectory, when the players are obvious in their moves, when there's certain inevitability to the decision-making of certain players, what will happen is a new player will emerge who see the contours of the game being played, and he will manipulate events and change the course of this game to benefit himself and his group. Okay? Now, Hegel's name for this person, for this player, is the world historical figure. Nietzsche's name for this player is the Übermensch, the Superman. The person who's able to step outside of history and control the reins of history in order to achieve his own ends. And by doing so, he's able to forever change the course of human history. Now, according to game theory, now that the game, the structure of the game has been, it is pretty clear, the Übermensch will now emerge. And in fact, today, we do have the Übermensch. And this Übermensch will manipulate the game in order to achieve his vision. And he will forever change the course of human history. And this person's name is Vladimir Putin. So in my next video, I'm going to discuss who Vladimir Putin really is, what he wants, and how he will achieve his vision. So thank you for today. I hope you enjoy the talk, and I'll continue the talk next week. Also, some of you in the comment section have been telling me how much you want to support my work, and I'm really grateful for it, and I would really appreciate your support. So what I've done is I've set up a Buy Me a Coffee account. So you don't have to do it. I'm committed to educating you for free. You don't have to pay me anything. Give me anything. But I would really appreciate it if you have the means to buy me a coffee. Okay, the link is down below. So thanks a lot, and I will see everyone next time.